basically launching to some hand grenades or controversial remarks and whatnot. Does anyone want to make a comment first? All right, okay, well, part of the reason why we assembled this workshop was to gather people from three very different areas, plastic physics, the downray sky and structure formation, to try to basically come to an understanding of basically what plasma physics has to do with basically structure formation and the downray sky. And the answer over the past few days has been somewhat slightly unclear, right, at some level. Okay? So I guess basically one of the questions that we had in the very beginning, right, of this conference was that basically, are plasma instabilities necessary? Right, so I'll throw that out. Are they actually necessary? Have we learned anything in the past few days?
Well, so I know that I have my bias about whether or not they're gamma ray halos, but I think we heard this morning about the very high gamma ray communities. Observation of gamma ray halos or not. So maybe I wanted to ask just how, I mean, you talked a lot about how stringent the limits were, but I didn't hear you put it out of bed. How certain are you that they don't exist, or how much room is there for them still to exist, at least in the handful of sources where you can do this? Because if we don't see halos, then I think that there's a limited number of options for circumventing them, right?
There certainly is a very limited number of options. I think it's pretty difficult at that point in time to sort of delineate down whether it's sort of that they could exist at 10% level of what we actually see, or what the limits are. As I said, I mean, I think finding them morphologically. We can probably look, I would expect us to make improvement on systematics and statistics over the next couple of years, pushing the limits by maybe a factor of 5. Sort of, not an order of magnitude, but that's where we go down to. I believe the easiest way to sort of settle this issue would be temporal variability, but there you rely on sort of monitoring large numbers of sources equally, well, very well. And so in Fermi, Fermi is great, but that's what we have. We won't improve on Fermi other than simply looking in time. So in a way, basically, if you talk about individual objects, you have to be lucky. If you talk about the ensemble, you may do something on a statistical basis. Well, there are various ideas, but up to now, I think it's pretty difficult to come up with a limit. And so ultimately, the final thing is whether or not you can actually rule it out by understanding the spectral energy distributions. And we've had this discussion over and over again. I mean, there are some people who are enormously skeptical about whether you believe any of this SED is being modeled. I mean, Reinhardt sort of couldn't believe anything which is not taking proper care of variability, and I see his point. But that's where the limit is. I mean, it's difficult to come up with a number. I think we can improve by a factor of 5 to sum it up, but beyond that, I see very little we can do from the observations. Now, a factor of 5, my understanding, a factor of 5 basically quenches it for the best cases we have. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you look at the best cases, if you rule it out by another factor of 5, then it's just not there. I mean, you might have a tiny little fraction that, I mean, even if you sort of dump things into heating the plasma, I mean, a few percent of the electrons will still survive for scattering, right? So in that sense, factor five will already do a lot.
The claim is that there have to be halos, but they could be vastly less luminous with something else, a ghosting image, right? You said in the best cases, I presume you mean the brightest halo models. But is there sufficient uncertainty in the very high energy gamma ray spectrum? I mean, I guess this is what you're getting at. That I mean, even if you just cut it off above 10 TeV, I mean, can we make reasonable statements about what we think the spectrum looks like between 1 and 10 intrinsic spectrum looks like between 1 and 10 TeV?
Well, I think if they're there up to 10 dB, I think we can. I think the question is whether they cut off before 10 dB or not. I mean, there are not that many sources where we actually, I mean, there's maybe three or four sources in the exoelectric sky where we go up to 10 dB in the gamma.
So I must personally apologize for the rain. I left my umbrella in my other office thinking, I think we're done with the rain. So it's clearly my fault.
I mean, I think the point is there's only three sources where we go up to 10 dB in the gamma ray sky. Right, so 10 dB, I think, is important because that's where you really have opacities larger than unity. And there are not that many.
Yeah.
But that's really where the current telescopes are limited. I mean, this is basically where we stand. And I don't think us improving on that before we have something like CTA. I mean, none of the existing facilities will much improve because we're simply rate limited. And it's the total area. It doesn't really help building a big strobe in the middle. You really need more square kilometers on the ground before you can improve on that.
I think the community, I mean, we could also run a workshop on the gamma ray production processes at TEV Energy. So community has not one single mechanism that explains TEV emission. This is issue on whether you could have, I mean, I think Roger Benford pointed that out, that you could also have intrinsic gamma-gamma annihilation, and that would right set in at about 100 GeV if you, but this depends very much where the gamma ray emission is produced. And everything else, how strong the instability will be, is basically dictated by the incoming flux of gamma rays. And as long as we don't know that, if that is much smaller than what we know, then there might be no halos at all, and there might be no inverse Compton emission, and there might be no instability. So I think the right thing is to understand the emission processes in better detail. Now, there are too many sources. So Stefan always shows sources where the synchrotron peak is sort of higher than the inverse Compton peak or the gamma ray peak. But there are other sources where it's the opposite, where the synchrotron peak is rather low and you have a factor 100 more in TEV energies. Now, he never shows those sources, and I'm sure his model will not work at all for those sources. So also these collaborations, they cannot agree on a common, if they write their discussion paper, say they just, what is written there is really outdated. I mean, they just say, let's fit one leptonic model with five different, you gave an example, since five different contributions. And then everybody who is going to push his hadronic models wants also to have a fit with hadronic emission. And they also show there. And then they say, well, both could be compatible with the data, and we need CTA to figure out. But I think when CTA, it will be the same situation. So I think we should single out some very nice, some clear sources, one like this PKS 0534, which is dominated at TEV energies. Most of the energy is coming out there, and we should not go for Makarian 501 where the gamma peak is relatively unimportant. So it depends very much on what kind of source you are talking about.
I mean, there are reasons for why people go after certain things, right? I mean, for once, the ones which have a very large dominance do not go up to high energies, right? So if you want to go to 10 dB, the only ones we have are all having a low quantum dominance. Of course, you can take issues with the desire to go to very high energies, but that's where you're left with. The other point is, of course, it's in part to the argument that you made earlier on. Again, the ones which have a high dominance are the ones where you know you have other radiation fields which are quite strong, right? Yeah. So if you want to go for things which are not so terribly affected by intrinsic absorption, you want to go to the guys which have a low Compton dominance. So it's exactly what you desire.
Yeah, but if you go to the high Compton dominance sources, you also expect, because it's probably external Compton emission, that was most people say, this would also mean that you would get lots of intrinsic photon absorption.
Right.
And there's not very much coming out to make a cascade. So
you're right. But that's exactly, I mean, if you want to understand whether that's an issue, right, you don't want to observe these sources. I mean, if you're really worried about whether there's halo or not, you need to go for things where you're reasonably clear that you're not sort of dumping most of your gamma rays into some sort of interaction on a parsec scale around the nucleus.
Yeah, but that interaction might explain this mysterious break at 100 GeV. Right? I mean, I asked, you know, what's special about 100 GeV, but not answer that question. Why is there a break at 100 GeV? I could understand it if this is intrinsic gamma-gamma absorption. It should be right there from the gamma ray photosphere. That's where the optical depth becomes unity. But nobody can tell me what's so special about 100 GeV.
Do we believe there's an intrinsic break at 100 GeV? I know he said
you can. There are theories where you can do that.
But
you get a break if you look at the time integrated spectra automatically, which is at these energies, and it's almost insensitive of the intrinsic parameters. So you can, but
there's in theory and there's in practice, and I've looked at a lot of spectra, and I've looked at the spectral softening up near 100 GeV, it's not true that most sources break or that all sources break at 100 GeV. And in fact, the very hard sources we're talking about, they're hard throughout the Fermi band. They're peaking well above that. And now it is true that most TeV sources that I'm aware of are falling by the time they get to a TeV or above a TeV. So somewhere between them.
Depends again whether you're talking about time integrated fluxes. That makes a huge difference in an evolving soul. And in a way, it's all determined by initial conditions. How much particles do you inject? What's the size of your emission region? Do you have adiabatic acceleration or not? This basically fixes the further fate. Now, when these hadronic people come, they put in, they don't care. They put in all these energies. Everything is accelerated to 10 to the 20 eV with a power law. And then, of course, they can explain everything. I think the field will only make progress if we understand the relevant radiation processes. And these might not be the same for all sources.
I think that is the generic problem. I mean, to me, I was actually very much convinced by your arguments about the background. I think sort of you can only do this much with an individual source, and you can always wiggle out and so on and so forth. But ultimately, if the effect exists, right, if you sort of dump things into their halos, there is this contribution to the background, and you can't get it. I mean, so to me, for a long while, that seemed to be the most promising enterprise to go. That actually was not very much discussed here. I mean, we had our discussions on the effect on the exogalactic diffuse gamma ray background, but I always, when you started out writing your models, I thought that was the best argument, right?
With the background, I mean, there's so much freedom you can do with the luminosity functions. I mean, I'm not an expert, but you just change the luminosity function a little bit. And
then
you cut off there and dark matter and then, I mean, this is really...
The question is, how much freedom do you really have with the AGN luminosity function? So
yeah.
I know if you go to an AGN conference and you say different AGN evolve with different luminosity functions, everyone will agree with you, absolutely. And then when you say, what that means is that this population doesn't increase at all in number density, they will look at you with shock and horror, because what they mean by variability in the evolution is tinkering around the edges, usually.
But
right?
I see, with this argument,
if
you got
where you see very deviant cases, it's usually because of a selection.
But I think you should really pursue this. With this argument, with the gamma ray background, you can probably eliminate lots of hadronic models, which would have emission at much higher energies.
I mean, the question, I'm still not clear, I understand to what extent the freedom we have with the evolution of the luminosity function limits our ability to rule out reprocessing. I mean, that's the biggest uncertainty on the empirical front to me, and on that, I'm not sure whether I understand where we are at the moment.
I don't think any of us understand. I think that we read statements about the negative evolution of the hard the hard gamma ray laser sample, and I don't understand why. I understand that that people certainly do this empirically, right? They go try to measure these things, they go count in the sky, and they give you a number. And I understand that process, but I don't understand why people aren't exercised over that. Why that's an acceptable, because it is so different from other AGN luminosity functions. Now that, and including parent luminosity functions for what we would call hard gamma ray lasers, I think.
Well, so, you have to realize that in these huge collaborations, we have many particle physicists that have absolutely no astronomical background.
On the other hand, you know, I mean, if it could be true. Look,
yeah.
Do we really know that there are a lot of very bright TV sources at redshift 1? And how would we know such a thing, right? I mean, there's no direct evidence. So it's always inferring. At some level, it's not all that different from saying, well, the spectral index is this from 100 GeV to 1 TeV. Let us continue it, right? What else? What could go wrong? You know, it's growing like this from 0.1 to 0.5 redshift. Let us extrapolate to 2. What could possibly go wrong? You know, it's not entirely the same.
The background will go wrong, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
the anisotropies, that's the other thing, right? I mean, I think that is something we need to actually look at, because there's the isotropic background and there's the anisotropies. I think the measurement that Marco actually showed is, it seems to be not too, I mean, there is some difference compared to the first paper, but it's not off by a factor of 2. So,
yeah.
But as I fear, we started to talk about is the number of sources could solve the anisotropy, but not the luminosity. These are two different aspects of the problem. So if you cut off the luminosity function at sort of small luminosities, you may be able to resolve the anisotropies, but you're still left with the isotropic background. And then there is the question, how much can you tinker with the redshift evolution? How much can you tinker with the intrinsic spectral breaks? And I guess the only way is increasing the sample size locally, that we can really pinpoint the local luminosity function precisely. That I think would be a very, very important thing to do, that at least that one is actually under control.
Well, on the spectra, so I mean that's one way data can help, right? So if you don't believe that we understand ab initio where the spectra come from, would it be enough to have local exemplars? I mean, we can in principle construct a redshift sequence of TeV sources. Right, and so you can look at the spectrum for the very close things and say, well, I'm going to presume that that's what the things that are a little bit further away that otherwise look the same look like. And so what we're doing is we're assuming that there's no redshift evolution in whatever local soft photon field might cut it off. Maybe that's true, and maybe it's not. But would that be a way to empirically?
The microwave background, it will at some energy, much higher energy, of course, produce.
Yeah, you can cut it off. You can calculate that. That's easy.
Yeah,
it's really I think the local photon background. You know, if you have starbursts in the nuclear star cluster or something, that will cause a problem. But even then, you can still constrain that even at Z, you know, redshift of a point few or one. So is that not simply getting very high quality, very high energy gamma ray spectra of nearby objects? Is that a way forward in an uncertain emission mechanism environment
to the process of how to explain the gamma ray spectra ab initio?
Let's try to sidestep the ab initio explanation and simply say the thing I'm going to look at redshift a half is the same sort of thing as I'm looking at redshift 0.05. And I'm just going to presume that, you know, if the optical through X-ray spectrum looks the same, so does the TeV spectrum.
I mean,
or optical through 100 GeV looks the same.
Obviously, they're sort of trying to go there, right? But I mean, I go back to my favorite example in 87. I mean, there's been this set of observations a couple of years back where people see M87 flare on the TeV and they go to the Chandra images and see HST1 flaring in X-rays. right, and say, it's flaring at the same time, the knot and M87 in TV. So the TV emission is coming from that knot and not from the core. Great. 3 years later, the same source varies in the TV, but nothing happens in knot HST1. Instead, the nucleus flares. So there's a correlation there. So actually, the TV is coming from the nucleus, but that was this flare, the other flare was that. 2 years later down the line, TV flares again. But neither part in M87 is variable. So I mean, this is where we are. I mean, it sounds ridiculous because it's all statistics.
Right.
But obviously, the models that you would come up with for these three TV flares would be entirely different. They have nice, beautiful data, right? But in one instance, you're sort of upskipping whatever stuff you have in HST1, which is very different from what you have in the nucleus. And in yet other case, you throw your hands up because there's nothing happening anywhere in the synchrotron spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So obviously you can improve on the signal to noise, no problem, and just integrate longer. But it's not obvious to me that that really will help all that much.
So
right? It's frustrating, but that's where we are, right?
So in your opinion, what do you think will help a lot? Do you think basically CTA beating down the gamma hill to by a factor of like 10, would that be...
Well, that would certainly happen. I mean, there's this, and then there is this issue of basically nailing down spectral energy distributions and sources which are either perfectly quiescent or as near quiescent as they can be, and really try to, I mean, at this point in time, we have a lot of freedom with the spectral modeling because you can always wiggle out in some part of the spectral energy distribution, right? There's this big gap between hundreds of kV and Fermi, where you can sort of make things extremely bright because there's absolutely no limit at the historical limit coming from Comtella, sort of like four orders of magnitude about anything we are interested in. But this is one hope that I do have. And the other question, I mean, that's a bit of an issue where, of course, there's a lot of debate, is whether or not we can nail down the effect of relativistic beaming. I'm still very much worried about the fact that we have this enormous freedom in the relativistic correction, which, I mean, boosting is an enormously powerful amplifier, and it can do almost anything at this point in time. And we have no way of connecting it to anything else. I mean, all the models that people come up with, and again, I agree with Reinhardt, these models are sort of in their infancy anyway, but they have Doppler factors of the order of 40, 50. I mean, that's what the typical model of SED is modeled with, right? And I think this is completely unrealistic. I mean, if all the blazars that we know, all the TV blazars, had Doppler factors 50 and above, you're basically arguing that every supermassive black hole above 10 of the 10 solar masses is a gamma ray source. Like, I mean, just sort of multiply the ones we know with the beaming correction, they're all TV sources, misdirected ones.
But if Fermi is not operating, then CTA, I mean, doing spectral fit just with CTA alone will not help. So
no, I mean,
there
that's,
must
that's,
be some overlap.
You want to do this now? I mean, this is a good time to do things.
Well, one will have CTA first light, 2025, and is Fermi satellites and still running? I
should
doubt
be.
It.
I mean, there's no technical reason it couldn't be running.
Well, but money.
There's
I'm thinking more in terms of short-term things. I mean, there's a handful of studies where you can work a little bit more on that. And then, again, the question is whether or not you can get a better handle on whatever the Doppler... I mean, the relativistic correction, to me, is an enormous issue when it comes to modeling things.
But there's so first off, having high Lorentz factors for the gamma ray sources isn't totally crazy. The lower power systems will typically have cleaner jets moving faster and won't self-quench their high energy gamma ray emission. So that's not crazy. But the other thing is, it isn't obvious to me, and maybe I missed the point, that we need to settle down the emission model in order to use the high energy gamma ray emission to probe for the existence of halos and et cetera. Because it doesn't matter if the emission in something like M87 came from the core or from knot A or for a combination of knot A and the core, by the time you've gotten 10 megaparsecs away, right? It's all the same. The only question is, what is the spectrum there? And is that a typical thing? And if we have, if what you're saying is, without having an ab initio model for what the gamma ray spectrum is, when you see the TEV flux from one source, the TEV spectrum from one source, you've seen it from one source, and I'm not never allowed to just empirically pretend that that is the same as other source.
But the production spectrum of pairs depends on the incoming gamma ray spectrum very much, in the absolute level, and also apart from this rising part, the extent will also depend on the power.
So is that in regard to the structure
of you produce
the instability, driving instability?
No, just if you make pairs out of photon-photon annihilation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the production spectrum depends on what you put in as your incoming gamma ray spectrum.
Sure.
But the
inverse Compton signal is going to be related to the time average inverse Compton is going to be related to the time averaged injection pair injection spectrum, which is related to the time average very high energy gamma ray spectrum. So I don't need the instantaneous spectrum to do that.
But right? This would be a factor of 100 smaller.
Because you
cut it off inside the source, and you will produce 10 times less pairs.
No. But if I look at something that's next door and I see, you know, some spectrum that extends out, that got to us, that's what's getting out of the source. That's what's surviving being quenched in the source by intrinsic pair production. Okay, and that's the stuff that's propagating to large distances.
You're right, but what I sort of mentioned, my point was a little bit like, if you had a viable model, right, and you knew that, for instance, the intrinsic spectrum in the TV domain had a spectral radius of this much, you go out and measure the one that's left, right? And if that's not the one that you got, if it's softer, then, well, the rest is pre-processing.
Right.
And so in that sense, if you actually had a model that told us take 0.229, right, if you had a model which told us, well, the intrinsic spectrum is as hard as 1.5, the one that we observed is a lot softer, right, I mean, what's the rest other than pre-processed emission?
Right.
So it would be a damn easy thing if you actually could believe our model.
If you had the model, but would it not be good enough to have an exemplar of the same system at high redshift and at low redshift, And you simply assert that if the rest of the SED is the same from optical through say 10 GeV, that you're just going to presume henceforth that from then on up it was intrinsically the same as well.
My understanding is that the electron spectra that you assume to model the gamma ray flux are not in accord with standard acceleration theories. I mean, if you take a relativistic shock, they tell you the spectrum is 2.24. That's too steep to reproduce what you need in order to model the gamma rays. This is one of the difficulties. But when Stefan said it's all influenced by a low energy cutoff, what's producing this low energy cutoff? Nobody. They're just waving your arms. They said, we assume this, we need it, we don't know how to get it. I mean, this is where the difficulties start.
So I think I want to move discussion on beyond gamma rays. So one small aspect of what we're talking about. So the other two fields that we talked about were the plasma physics side and on the structural formation side. So then basically I would pose the question to the structural formation people. Are plasma stability necessary for any problem in structural formation whatsoever? Might be a short answer.
I said there's short answers we don't know yet, so there are problems. It could be
the others. But you gave a talk where the purely significant problems, right?
No, I think there are significant problems in the long loop if you don't include any baryonic effects.
Right.
But those simulations that I showed that resolve these local loop problems, at least potentially resolve them, don't yet require laser heating.
Right.
But there are other problems on small scales that we haven't explored yet. And so they're sort of still open, I would say. And maybe laser heating could be a solution. But so I think there's no clear case of any problem that needs it to be solved, but there are still problems that are open and then we don't know whether it's a feasible solution or not.
I see. But then, so then the other question is, at what level can you disentangle this from the strong baryonic effects that you get from like supernova pieces?
Well, I think probably through the, so on the one hand, it's hard to make a prediction before doing an actual simulation because these things are sometimes you're surprised by your simulation outcomes. But I think one thing that I would look at first is the environmental dependence. So, for example, we've already seen that blazar feedback doesn't change basically anything observable in the local group. So we can use the local group to fix the other parameters. And now if you go to the voids, we fix the supernova. So suppose we don't use blazar feedback and the voids don't work. Then if we start changing the supernova feedback, we'll also change the local group. But we don't want that. So then maybe, so since blazar feedback is basically does nothing in the local group, we have, in a sense, the freedom to adjust that and or to apply that and get maybe a an effect that's only effective in the void, and there's reasons to believe that that's the case. But it may also be that, again, it changes something in the voids, and then we don't know. But yeah.
Could I ask along those lines? You know, the solution for the past decade for getting from dark matter to stars and galaxies has been feedback, right? And hence we even use the buzzword in the title of this conference, although in a slightly insidious way. Could you describe how feedback is implemented in the Eagle simulation?
Yes. So for a long time, feedback, well, we knew that feedback is potentially working, but it didn't work in simulations. It wasn't effective enough. So, and the key to getting it effective now is basically what was done previously is that, well, we have gas particles and star particles are formed from gas particles in those regions where the gas is dense and therefore has a short cooling time. That's what, why it can form stars. And so then you locally give feedback to the gas particles that have short cooling times. So the, and if you inject feedback thermally, this feedback or this energy is radiated away, and there's very little in terms of outflows driven from this feedback. But what we've done now in the Eagle model is that we set a target temperature for the gas because we know that supernova feedback doesn't just heat gas to, you know, a few times 10 to the 5 Kelvin, makes gas really hot. So we set a target temperature, and then
the target temperature means a lower bound of the temperature, so then the radiation will be reduced.
No, so okay, I'll explain. So what we do is we set a target temperature that the gas particles should be heated to by supernova feedback, and then depending on the gas density, we hit a certain number of particles so that we still inject the same amount of energy. So suppose we inject 10 to 51 Ergs for a supernova event. And so now in some regions where the gas is already hot, we heat a lot of gas to that temperature. In other regions where the gas is cold, we hit fewer particles, but we still heat them to that temperature. And so the target temperature is above the peak of the cooling curve so that the cooling time of these newly heated gas particles will be long, and then that gas can expand and eventually drive winds. So this is how we sort of overcome the problem that supernova feedback was previously lost through radiative cooling, because it was always dumped into the dense gas particles that weren't really heated to those energy to those temperatures where supernova feedback should operate.
Yes. 10 to the 7K for supernova feedback,
yeah,
and 10 to the 8K for AGN feedback.
No, so for AGN feedback, this was varied. So it's hotter for AGN feedback. And on the plot where I showed the Eagle galaxy Salamas function, for example, there was actually a blue line that's the Eagle reference model. There was also a red line that has a higher target temperature for AGN feedback. So that.
So it's 10 to the 8.5.
I think it was 10 to the 9 for the.
But I think that's in conflict with the mean compound Y, right? I mean, I guess that exceeds the limits from the mean compound Y.
So I'm not so familiar with the high mass, and so in the local group, AGN feedback isn't the dominating source or the dominant source. The target temperature is actually, so we have a few, let's say, free parameters in the model, and the target temperature is an interesting one because if you set the target temperature high, very high, then feedback is actually less effective in dwarf galaxies. You have a few particles and you heat them so that they can escape. But if you make the target temperature even higher, you had fewer particles and then still escape. So if you reduce the target temperature, basically you get to a point where the gas no longer exceeds the escape velocity and then feedback becomes ineffective. But if you make it too high, then, well, feedback, then the basically the mass that you eject becomes lower. So it's one of those subgrid parameters that we don't really know what the physical choice should be, because of course in reality supernova feedback doesn't operate on these supermassive gas particles, but it's much more of a process.
So how sensitive are you to that target temperature? Like the factor two sensitive?
Yes, so this is one of the variables that we need as a free parameter to calibrate the model, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's, well, if we change by a factor of 2, it wouldn't matter, but if we change by a factor of 10, it would matter, and it would change the shape of the Feynman stellar mass function.
So, can the 7K gas emit X-rays? Have they actually made X-ray images of
so there is, yeah, there's Rob Crane, who's supposed to do that at some point, so that's his project. I'm not touching it, but yeah, we are.
I mean, this is a very important test. But
yes.
I understand this is
probably
you want your gas
yeah.
to basically raise a certain cooling time threshold
yeah.
because that's effective for the water.
Yeah.
You don't want this gas to cool fast because then you get too many stars.
Yeah.
But the way how you achieve this, I think, is by.
But there's only one way. There's
another
way.
Yeah, there are
yeah.
other ways. Yes.
I know. I mean, other people switch for hydrodynamics.
Yes,
and
then that would move out of the dynamic and without doing anything, then start to switch on hydrodynamics.
I know all about
yes.
this. That's actually a right way to do this. Which
no.
It's
not the right
way. Cosmic ray feedback, right?
No. I'm saying in simulation, that's not the right way to do it.
No, but I think with these current models, I mean, these are tricks which are necessary
yes.
to actually sort of prohibit cooling and, you know, I mean,
yes.
accept the tricks, but
prohibit cooling at high density.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, how do you know that these prescriptions work at all galaxy mass?
Well, I mean,
no,
so for example,
that's just put in my hand. I think
yeah,
very simply.
Yeah, but we do see that it works by looking at the fact that. So, for example, I think that one strong case of the Eagle model that in the Shea et al. Paper, it reproduces with fairly few such switches the galaxy stellar mass function of 5-order magnitudes. And we can now even extend it to the local group, which was not used for the calibration, and it still works. So I think it's, even though there are, I would say, you know, not so physically, not clearly physical models, these subgroup models are somehow open to calibration, but they reproduce many observables. So for example, also the sizes of galaxies come out right with these feedback parameters. If you change them drastically, you puff up the disks too much. I mean, in the Eagle simulation, the disks are a little bit too thick at the moment. But so it's not that we have one free parameter to adjust to one observable, and then we have another knob to get another observable right. So I think the number of observables that these simulations
yeah.
produce is fairly high, and the number of completely free parameters is quite small. So
it's order from chaos is you know, a constant theme, even simply in astronomy, right?
Mm-hmm.
This Kennicott-Schmidt law for star formation is one great example. I defy
mm-hmm.
anyone in this room to actually model the process of star formation. But on galaxy scales, it's a power law, and it's a sorted problem in sparkles,
mm.
right? Okay, but that said, what I think what you're saying is that you have a model which you know is microscopically surely wrong.
Yes.
And you hope macroscopically mocks up the right physics.
Yes.
And you are able to calibrate it in such a way that the physics you put into your simulation reproduces. At the end of the day, the distribution of galaxies that we see.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't mean that the physics you put into your simulation is right.
Yes, of course.
Okay, so then if, I mean, how far down the road do we have to go if we were going to put in an initial physical process or a handful of additional physical processes to verify whether or not those make sense or not? Because it seems like then you have to reopen the the can of worms of calibrating all of these things again if you wanted to do it fair.
Well, so that's why I'm saying that it's important to test this in different environments where you would hope that they're not completely degenerate. So, for example, a dwarf galaxy that's in an overdense environment or that's in a void, these internal processes like supernova feedback should be exactly the same. But external processes like maybe laser heating that affects how much gas this dwarf galaxy can accrete should depend strongly on environment. So I think that's where we need to go. If we said, for example, well, we should maybe increase the efficiency of stellar winds or something compared to supernovae, or have changed the IMF so that we get more type 2 supernovae or something, that would be very difficult to adjust because it's completely generated with lots of other variables. But I mean, something else, for example, that the supernova feedback model predicts and gets fairly accurate is the things like the stellar mass metallicity scaling relations. So that because at the same time that you give supernova energy, also deposit metals and you have stellar evolution, so the next generation of stars reprocesses those metals and you accumulate metals as you recycle the gas. So for example, if you change the supernova feedback very strongly, you'll probably get rid of all those metals and then the stellar mass metallicity relation goes off.
But to be fair, people are doing very high resolution simulations on small scales to understand what is going on.
Yeah, that's also true. But they don't really, I think that's still a gap that we have to close. So from those simulations that look at individual supernovae to cosmological simulations, many orders of magnitude in resolution. And the idea is that these high resolutions should eventually inform the subgrid models of the cosmological simulations. They don't really do that yet.
In practice, or in principle, that's a wonderful, wonderful plan. And in practice, it's a desperate hope. Because people can't model the formation of stars in a molecular cloud. Well, so how far down are you going to go now? Right? So, they make stars. It just doesn't look like molecular clouds we have.
But you see, one motivation of the model he's talking about is a multi-phase medium, right? You have a hard phase just embedded everywhere, then basically if you dump your energy in the hard phase, that will be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's one motivation. But of course, you cannot resolve.
Well, you're resolving
the phase media, so then you put it by hand.
You're resolving the hot phase by heating up a single particle or something to the hot phase and not letting
it cool. So, but the motivation is the multi-phase media.
Right. Is it really obvious that purely local, or that's purely local and doesn't depend upon the environment at all? I mean, I would imagine it depends a little bit upon how much gas is accreting into your halo, right?
Well, if you look at this as a zoo of models, right, momentum-driven and scaling with escaping velocity, scaling with local density.
Yeah, so these models were the feedback scales with the halo velocity. I think I consider these the most dodgy ones, because someone shouldn't know which halo it lives in.
This exactly. But then, again, that's attuned for producing observation.
Yes, but I think in that sense, so I think there are different degrees to which models are unphysical, and if the star somewhere knows, you know, what the escape velocity of the halo is.
Does it work?
This is called mass stress.
Okay, so it works. Okay, so what you said is that you can put in a completely unphysical model that will cause tilt to rail, but it still works.
Well, it works. I mean, you have semi-analytical models that I would consider very unphysical, and they were much better than hydro simulations. But
No, actually, I don't agree with that. I think that a similar model does not intend to answer physical questions.
Okay.
It's just a data summary, in a sense.
Yes, okay. But so they
so in that way, I don't
data.
Claim, but I'm just saying I compress my thing into several parameters so that you can check, right?
So let me ask you a different question then. Okay, so there are many, many different subgrid models, right?
Yes.
And they all produce the same result. So all at some level unphysical.
Yeah.
at the end of the day, how do you judge one unphysical separate mass from another?
Well, so for example, they may all reproduce the stellar mass function, but that's in one sense something fairly easy because of these self-regulation. So it doesn't really matter if you make a few more stars now because it means, so because of self-regulation, I think stellar mass function is relatively easy to get, although also most simulations haven't achieved that. There are a few now that do that in different ways, but there are many more that fail. But then you can look at other, so you use, for example, stellar mass function for calibration, but what I showed is the Tully Fisher relation that comes out also from the simulation that wasn't touched at in the calibration. So you try to look for observables that you haven't used in the calibration of the model to weed out the good from the bad, I think. And then every simulation fails at some point, and then you try to improve by looking at what failed. So I think that they're not completely degenerate if you look at just sort of the front page of Illustrious and Eagle, they look very similar, but if you look at...
they're not similar. Even in the normalized function, stellar mass functions, they're very different.
Yeah, okay.
Do we understand? We don't.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, you showed the normalized function, right?
Yes.
Maybe but bring the discussion back to the topic of laser gating. So you made a very interesting comment, Ujjol, that there's basically two types of feedback. So there is sort of an early phase of perhaps star formation related feedback. There's a later phase which is sort of preventing stuff from falling in, and you basically said your models identified a time scale and a mass scale where this perhaps changes the mode of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So
but whether it's a blazer, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, the question we ask, we cannot really say that's required or not. We are just saying, okay, I have this model, what is the consequence of this? What are the predictions that I can check, right? You cannot really say blazer model is the correct one. You can never say that.
Well, you can't say at this point, but perhaps if you work out some of the implications of this model, say environmental impact will get to
well, but even there, you can find another model as well. Then you can, that basically says this model is good, consistent.
But it works generally different because it heats us from the outside in, right? It doesn't heat the stuff from the inside out. So there will be some, I think, the versions of these models are very different. So I would be surprised if you can mock up some inside-out feedback model that mocks exactly the properties up that you would have with laser beam, because it's so different. I mean, you don't enrich the stuff with metals, right? Any inside-out model will enrich the gas with metals, right? I mean, so there's an upper limit because you can observe the number of metals there.
Maybe, you know, historically, if you look at the Ostroika and McKee, the proposed explosion model, where galaxy formation occurred in void. That basically says you have an explosion that occurred in high density region, then push everything to the void, then new stars forms there. I'm not saying that's the correct one, but you can always imagine crazy. Yeah.
No, but I think, so for example, in the long group simulation, we now say that we have a plausible model, and we think that supernova feedback and reionization are both important ingredients to get the long group right. I mean, it may not be that this is the final answer, but at least this is now one plausible model, and so far the only one that can reproduce observations. And I think in the ideal case, we come to the same conclusion in voids that with blazers, it's plausible. Then there might be some other mechanism that we haven't thought of yet that looks like the action laser feedback, but it could. But I agree that there's fundamental differences between basically sort of nature, which is the self-regulation of self-making from the galaxy itself, and nurture, which is the effect of the environment. And there could be something that there's very little else going on. So there is this effect that structure formation is delayed in voids, so that could also be driving some environmental difference. But otherwise, for example, there's very little stripping or harassment or strangulation or all these things that people invoke in dense environments to regulate.
I have to just point out that laser heating is by far socially the most acceptable option.
Yes. Okay. Well, Yeah, but very general. For you guys, you should really make predictions from your side. Say their resistance, they're wrong. These predictions, their resistance energy. Make predictions for us to.
They did, and then 100 pages of text.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the prediction that we're testing now.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, the other prediction side we did, the basically brought my experts in the Lyme Alpha Forest.
Yeah.
The question is, that, like, how much room really is there in the Lyme Alpha Forest to allow blade up eating? When we first did it, we found factor 10 increase in temperature, and even as strong as high, it's hard to hide a factor of 10. But apparently, it's actually not so hard.
Yeah, it comes in at, like, if it came in at a slightly higher redshift, I think you'd be okay. It's just kind of when the Lyme Alpha Forest is going away. That said, I think that community can do better to look for it. And Martin Hanel had one approach.
Right.
You are really changing the void properties in the Lyme Alpha Forest. The amount of absorption from voids is hard to measure because you don't know where the continuum of the quasar is, so that you can like if we knew exactly where the continuum is, then I think you could measure this. Like, then you'd say, oh, all my voids have, you know, 0.5% optical depth, and there's a factor of 10 difference. Like, if in the blazar model, like, I think there you expect everything to come exactly to the continuum. So I don't know. There might be something smart you can do. Because I think with the Lyme Alpha Forest, we have a great model for where the structure is. So we can look for small deviations from that model potentially. But it does come in a place that's harder to probe, and at redshifts that are not as good as I think in the strongest blazar feedback models, probably you can rule those out for the Lyme Alpha Forest.
That's related to. I guess two very closely related questions. From line and alpha, we get columns and widths, and those are proxies for densities and temperatures, and they're not very good proxies. I mean, that's part of the problem. And then the other thing is, we talk about the temperature-density relationship a lot, right? And there's some power law that characterizes this, but I think Nastrid's talk. We saw that's really going, if we're in a blazar heated universe, that's really a very bad way to describe it. We have to start talking about distributions, temperature and density. And I think that's true in even the standard case as well. Normally, we talk about distributions. So how do we exploit the fact that we're predicting different ranges of the temperature density? So that might be a way to get at this question of what the normalization is, right? Maybe we predict a larger range of variations.
Yeah.
I don't think we exploit that well. And as you said, any column density line width plot has to be calibrated against simulation to have temperature density. But in your simulation, you put your physics in. So if your physics is not exact, I mean, you only see what you expect. You can only test one model, so obviously if you don't test against a certain thing, you won't see it. And then once you actually, I mean, if you look at, on the other hand, you have your simulation, you get some model, and you have your column density in line with distribution, and you start put your absorbers on that plot, typically people put one black dot for every absorber. And so unless you have a better modeling, with a 2D histogram or something, once you have one dot at a given point, you have no idea if they're 100 or 1. And if you just visually look at any plot you see in the literature, it's often, it doesn't really guide your eye, and you don't really know where most of your absorbers lie. And so maybe there's room to have a better better statistical model of this distribution so that we actually know where most of the stuff is. And I don't really know what we should do, maybe just do the histogram or if there's something better. But people look at the low envelope and the rest is much less looked at, but I'm sure there's plenty of information. But
maybe HY is not a very good tracer. So, but then you could use a metal line, like oxygen 6, but it's very, you know, finalized, and more sensitive to 10 to the 5, it's kind of gas.
But isn't this a non-equilibrium physics that says this?
No, why?
So is it, how difficult is this to model?
It's not difficult to model. It's just how to get metals there.
Do they survive that far away from?
Mm-hmm.
I thought metal lines were more close to galaxies, more sort of.
Not necessarily. If you go to very low column density, you might see in some other places as well.
So in a void, we can have an oxygen line.
Why not? You have metal there, that can be, right? The temperature is correct.
Yeah. Well, if you want to get the metal up in a void, that would be escaping wind from rather high velocity. And that might cause that more polarity from us.
But that's another question I want to ask. In Llama 4 course, when we detect metallicity, we always detect metallicity, right?
Or we can detect where metals have gone to in a statistical way.
Yeah.
Like, I think the statement is that depending on the ion, but like oxygen 6 is the ion that we can see to the lowest densities, and there you can get almost the mean density of the universe, and at least So if you stack a lot of mean density of the universe pixels, then you see oxygen 6, and then they can even make statements about what the filling fraction is, and it has to be greater than 10%. I think this mean density is a little lower than what they're able to do, but slightly overdense. And so the metals are getting out there, like at least at the 10% level.
Could you explain, how do you know along the line of sight that was the mean density region? Three-dimensional density.
Yeah, there's a pretty tight correspondence between column density and the density of an absorber.
But that depends on photoionization model, because, or, is that right? Because then low density, or if you have high ions, that means you have low density. The photons, the number of photons is fixed. It's just like a laser.
So you need to know what the ionizing background is.
Yeah.
And for oxygen 6, that's harder than for hydrogen. You can measure it via this optical depth matching.
So you have the temperature, you have the density, and you have the UV background at each local point.
But the UV background is highly uniform, like in most of the IGM.
Sure. But at that point, that gives you. I guess a slew of possible choices for a given Lyman alpha line, right? You can either turn up the UV or turn up the temperature.
But I'm saying the UV is one parameter for the whole universe at that much.
Sure.
You can think of it that way. So
measure
the UV at 1 Rydberg and 4 Rydberg, and then you have to kind of model the spectrum of your sources. But for like oxygen 6, it's quasars, and I think you have a decent model for what the UV is, like to a factor of 2, and so then you can say to within a factor of 2, I know what density this is.
This factor.
This
10% limit you give for the volume filling factor, is that, do you have any handle on whether there's a redshift dependence of that? No.
So the Lyman alpha forest, the sweet spot for measurements are between redshift 2 and 4, and so there's a claimed redshift scaling that's rather weak with redshift, but consistent. I think it's consistent with half of the enrichment occurring after redshift 4, So if you're looking at redshift 2.5 or so, so they have detected this the redshift dependence.
Okay, well, we're effectively out of time, but does someone want to say a few words about the nonlinear plasma physics, the challenges that remain?
So I have one question, but for our community, we have a symmetric model, and it's not a very popular. Based on what I hear, why you guys don't have a similar model? Just put in the parameters and then see what kind of consequence you have, and run a Monte Carlo Markov chain and see
for what?
For the background, for luminosity function.
Oh, a semi-analytic model for the...
You put in your model. Then you just put in all the uncertainties, and then you have a prediction. Then, well, some part are well constrained, some part are not. That's a statistical approach, right?
Yeah.
So I guess my problem would be like, it would not be clear to me at least how to put in a Blazor hidden parameter.
No, what I'm saying is start from AGN luminosity function, for example, as a function of redshift. Then you use one or two parameters to make connection between AGN and the Blazor. And then the rest I don't understand in detail, you know, the heating or beaming. Each of them is one parameter.
So write down the Blazor Drake equation.
Yeah.
So I guess we never quite developed it to the level of that because we felt or we thought perhaps mistakenly that we could instead of parameterizing a large set of ignorant leaps, we could actually work the physics out at the leaps. Maybe that was enormously arrogant. But then we got stuck on leap number one, which was the plasma physics. Then we went to the observers and begged for help.
So that's a galaxy formation, right? You need a way to compress or to summarize your data.
Right.
And then you learn something from, empirical.
I suppose the other point is that when you develop one of those semi-analytic models, surely you focus on a particular set, a particular class of observations that you want to make sure that this is at least qualitatively correct for. And in this context, we are still at the early stage of understanding what are really the classes of observations that have the most leverage. So where do we need to focus on?
That's exactly what empirical model can give you, right? And I make predictions, and then this is the most important observations to make.
Mm-hmm.
Something in that direction. That's even exactly the power of this kind of approach. Well, as an outsider, well, galaxy formation practitioners are just doing the same thing.
But data is your data start. So basically, you have a lot of things to calibrate on, and I think that is what we started to discuss.
Right.
We are not yet at this point that we have plenty of data that we can have our test summits calibrate, and then we make predictions for another set of.
You can only use the data you have,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and that's the degeneracy in your model or uncertainty in the model, but that has to be in that way.
No,
you have to characterize all the uncertainties. Otherwise, you say, okay, I have a banana shaped, posterior, I emphasize this end, and you emphasize that end, then you never reach agreement. So that's it.
Well, I think it's late, so I think we should bring this meeting to a close. Right? Do you want to say a few words?
I'm the oldest person in the room, so maybe I should take the initiative and thank all the organizers for putting up this very nice meeting. And I definitely learned a lot of things I normally don't look at.
Yeah.
And I think it was very successful. And maybe we can convince Christoph to. In Germany, we have these Hereo seminars, which are very easy to get. And you can even run this in a hat in the Alps. So you just write this three-page proposal, and as far as I know, all proposals get accepted. But there is one caveat. 30% of the speakers have to be female, so you have to make sure that they
technically, but right, apparently we can actually more.
Yeah, so 30%, that's, and then you could rerun this in 2 years. But for the moment, thanks a lot for putting this up and bringing us over here, and I think everybody enjoyed it. So.
And on behalf of the organizing committee, I want to thank everyone for coming. It's been a very, very enlightening and productive 3 days, right? Where we learned that there still may or may not be hope for the community, right? And that we are closer in some aspects and much further away in other aspects. Thank you very much for everyone coming up.